cooperation over chaos. We are all in this together.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour podcast. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're on stolen land, land that was nurtured by First Nations people for millennia before their land was stolen. In that time, by focusing on their country, nurturing their country and their communities, they acquired a great amount of ancient knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge and wisdom that we are going to be very helpful for us as we face up to the climate crisis.
If you rely on certain Australian politicians and the mainstream newspapers for your energy news, you can't be blamed for thinking that, renewable energy, that's what's driving our electricity prices up. Because now for years and years we've been told this story that wind and solar are unreliable and batteries don't work and, we need coal for baseload power and so on. But listen, folks, the figures from Australia's electricity market, the facts, tell a very different story. For instance, here in the first quarter of 2026, battery systems across Australia tripled the amount of solar energy that they shifted from the middle of the day and then into the evening peak. That's compared with a year ago. So three times more battery electricity in the evening. So instead of wasting all this surplus solar generation that we now have in the middle of the day, batteries are storing it and then releasing it when we out in the houses need it most in our households after sunset. Batteries deliver up to 3,500 megawatts into the grid during the evening peak. And what does that mean? It means that wholesale electricity prices fell by 12% nationally compared with a year ago. Don't buy the lies that renewables make electricity more expensive. It's a lie. It's a hoax. Prices fell, and that's a fact, by 12% nationally this first quarter of 26 compared to a year ago. Here in Victoria, the story is even better. Prices fell with 28%. So what does that mean? That means that gas is being squeezed out. We used to use gas generators to make sure that we had enough electricity in the evening. We don't need that anymore. Now we have these large-scale renewable energy battery storage, and they replace gas. So gas-fired power generation is now at its lowest level since 1999. One in 25 Australian homes now has its own battery, and it keeps growing. Battery capacity expanded by 8 gigawatts in just the last 12 months. It's one of the fastest growth rates anywhere in the world, and it's being noticed outside of Australia. But somehow, we can still have politicians here in this country who claim that our renewables don't work. How do they get away with it? I really wonder. And in some areas, in Queensland, in New South Wales, and in South Australia, it's even better than that. Some of the electricity retailers are now beginning to offer electricity at no charge between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's free electricity, 3 hours every day. And how is that possible? Because there's so much solar, there's such an abundant amount of electricity in the network during the day in these hours between 11 and 2, that the electricity prices actually fall below zero. So that's why, you know, retailers are just passing on some of those savings directly to their customers. It's not everyone who can access free electricity yet, but it shows which direction we're going. That's the reality. We are entering an era where electricity sometimes is so plentiful that the retailers give it away for free. How does that match with being told that renewables make electricity more expensive? We, the consumers, are benefiting from renewables. And that's not a hoax. I have to say it. It's not a hoax. It is a fact. And that's the story that the politicians and that the media should be telling you. Every solar panel and every battery is not just lowering our emissions, making our climate more safe. It's also strengthening our energy security, so we are not reliant on fossil fuels coming from the Middle East and so on. We're saving money, and it's making our energy system more resilient, regardless of what turmoil there might be out there in the world. That's the story. Renewables? You're being told a hoax when you listen to Pauline Hanson saying that renewables are a hoax. It's actually the other way around. And that's what we should be singing out loud and proud from our rooftops. And I think you should remember next time you're voting in an election, what about bringing in some honesty and some integrity back into politics in this country? Should we? Anyway, it's time for some global news. Over to Colin Market, OAM, who has always been looking at what's been happening around the big world in the week that passed. Over to you, Colin. What do you have for us?
Yes, thank you, Mick. And I've got an interesting little list of things here. But I want to reiterate all of the things that you've been saying, but add on to it too that the Murdoch Press is very much into that. The Murdoch Press is totally opposed to any environmental change, as is Donald Trump. And that's where my roundup begins. In America, where the Trump administration has abandoned its legal efforts to halt wind energy projects across the United States. It also dropped its challenge to the court ruling that threw out the Trump law that had stopped federal permits for wind projects. The states that had challenged his order, that's Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Vermont, and New York, issued a joint statement describing the new ruling as one of the most significant legal victories against the Trump White House's campaign against the energy transition. And the decision finally validates the December the 8th ruling by the U.S. District Court Judge Patty Saris, which concluded that Trump's January 2025 executive order was unlawful. In doing so, it called the sweeping ban on wind projects arbitrary and capricious and exceeded the president's authority. This is a neat setback, a major setback for the Trump stopping Biden's rollout of environmental projects. Not surprisingly, environmental and wildlife groups applauded the move. And Nancy Pine of the Sierra Club, which is the largest environmental group in the US, said, "Renewable energy continues to prevail and grow in spite of Trump's relentless attacks." Now, home to Australia, where the Bureau of Meteorology confirmed last week that a very strong El Nino global weather event had been declared, and it forecast that it could be the most severe in decades. This elevated the risks of drought, heat waves, and bushfires for all of Australia in this coming summer. But the forecast is likely to be much more severe in India, where scientists are warning that a strong El Nino would be disastrous for the whole region, which is already grappling with deadly heat waves, along with an energy crisis due to the crisis in the Middle East. The warning states that if El Nino causes the rains to arrive later, which is likely, the heat wave that has engulfed India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka in recent weeks will continue longer. This will cripple livelihoods and potentially lead to thousands of deaths. Delayed rains would prove particularly devastating for farmers, who are relying on the rains for their next crop planting season. A heat wave there in May had already caused damage to wheat and mustard crops, and it was feared that El Nino could worsen drought conditions and have a devastating effect on food security throughout the subcontinent. El Ninos are triggered by warming the ocean around the equator and a weakening of trade winds that blow around the Pacific Ocean, which reduces the rainfall on Australia's eastern seaboard. And Australia's Bureau of Meteorology was late among the international weather agencies in officially declaring this year's El Nino. The US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration declared it at the beginning of June and warned then of its effects. They said that it would rank among the largest events in the historical record going back to 1950. Japan also declared the El Nino alarm more than 2 weeks ago. Now, the last El Nino in our region ran from spring 2023 to early summer 2024, and it included Australia's driest 3 months on record. That was August, September and October 2023. That was the summer of bushfires, if you remember. Now, the new BOM statement said it's too early to say how the current El Nino would play out, noting that a rain ban had swept across the southern Australia this week. But with El Nino underway, the three-month weather outlook is for hotter temperatures and below median rainfall. The Bureau said that a warmer Pacific Ocean usually caused global temperatures to rise, saying that southern Australia had already experienced above average temperatures this year and this winter. It added that global warming had generated a long-term warming trend and noted that since 2000, Australia had recorded 14 of its 15 warmest years since records began. Most models suggest this event is likely to be strong to very strong, the Bureau statement warned. And a statement from the UN's Weather Service, that's the WMO, said El Ninos have a global reach that are associated with severe storms and flooding in the Americas, droughts and floods in North Africa and Asia, and heat waves, droughts and bushfires in Australia. So we can't say we haven't been warned. And that relatively unhappy note ends my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Jose Ramos. Jose is an action researcher, a futurist and political activist focused on the planetary commons. He is founder and co-director of Futures Lab, a network of over 1,500 experimenters and action foresight, a leading boutique futures consultancy, co-editor of the Journal of Future Studies, and co-founder of the Participatory Futures Global Swarm, all focused on the future. So, Jose, welcome to the Sustainable Hour.
Thank you.
With that obvious focus on the future, tell us about how that's all evolved.
Well, I got involved quite a while ago. I've been in what people term the future studies or foresight field for about 25 years. I initially, you know, I had finished the postgrad. I did my bachelor's in California at UC Irvine. And I was, you know, essentially just kind of exploring what to do next. I had lived in Japan for a couple of years. I had lived in Spain. I was sort of in between things. And I was looking for a field that would allow me to explore the future and also address my kind of an intuition that I wanted some agency. I wanted to understand how change actually happened. So I discovered a couple of programs. I began in Houston, actually, studying with Peter Bishop, They have a program in studies of the future at the, at that time it was the University of Houston, Clear Lake. And then I met a beautiful, incredible Australian woman who convinced me to come to Australia. And, you know, I Mr. Romantic over here, I ended up in Melbourne. And then I ended up, luckily, there was a program at Swinburne, and I finished the degree at Swinburne. So I did my master's in Swinburne in what's called strategic foresight. And then I took a bit of time in between. I taught at TAFE, political economy at TAFE, for a while in a bridging program. And we ended up moving to Geelong, actually, where you're at, because my wife started teaching at Geelong Grammar. And so here I was next to an oil refinery and Corio. But I had enrolled in a PhD by that point. And what I was really interested in is, and I think because I had been introduced to what globalization was in the 90s, I had lived in Taiwan, I had lived in Japan, in Spain, I you know, grew up in Los Angeles. So I really had a kind of visceral experience of the global economy, and I wanted to understand these things, but I also knew there were some serious problems. I had been keeping track of the protests against the WTO in Seattle. You know, I had been an activist from my college days, in my community college days. I was campaigning on the Rio summit, you know, back in 19, I think it was 91. So I had that in my background, and I really wanted to experience, really wanted to understand, you know, we're locked into this globalization process, but what are the alternative visions and pathways for ecological justice, for social justice? You know, these are some of the criticisms that were leveled against economic globalization, you know, how it was essentially creating almost like a political policy buffer zones for, you know, for corporate expansion, but you know, wasn't supporting environmental and social goods. So that's what my PhD was about. So I did that at Queensland University of Technology, and it was on alternative globalization pathways. But it looked at the World Social Forum, which was a really important social process at the time. It was a counter Davos. Davos, you know, the World Economic Forum is where the billionaires gather to, you know, formulate their plans. You know, and that's the forum for capitalism. And the counter Davos, which emerged in Porto Alegre, was to say, okay, well, another world is possible. That was the motto. We can go past this. We can do something different. So how do we do that? And so that brought literally millions of people together over multiple decades to discuss, to dialogue, to share ideas, to have interchanges. They happened all over the place. Porto Alegre, Mumbai. I went to the Mumbai one, Caracas in Venezuela. A number of different places around the world. And also was a co-organizer of the local Melbourne branch. So we did a Melbourne social forum as well. In fact, that's where BZE launched their initiative, you know, where Matthew Wright actually said, this is what we're doing. He got incredible support. And it was just that kind of place where we were open to, we knew even back then that, you know, like, we've got some serious challenges here and we have to take our imagination one step further. So so we attracted those kinds of people into that space, and it became a networking space and a connecting space alongside many other, as you know, many other venues and events around Australia. So that was sort of my path. And then after I finished my PhD, I just slipped into doing contract work for different agencies and governments, and you know, I had a young child, I had a mortgage, you know, moving into middle age, so you know what that shtick is. But you know, I've always continued to write about the commons, write about alternative globalizations. And I've developed that thinking, and I continue to develop it. And, you know, my work under Futures Lab is really focused on that kind of transformational experimentation. You know, how do we experiment with ideas and approaches that can address our real challenges that we're facing? So
that is wonderful, Jose. And you're the first person we've had on that I can recall who has studied the future. I would really like, first of all, an overview from you as somebody who's taken a really micro look at where we're going as a planet, if you like. Have you got a positive outlook for mankind?
That's tricky. It's complex, that one, you know, and we have to be careful. Like, we don't want fatalism. We need to search for our power, search for pathways. What people would say in future studies is that optimism and pessimism may not be the most useful frameworks, because optimism can often mean that you think it's going to be fine. So why do I need to be involved? And pessimism can also mean it's all screwed. And, you know, in that case, you know, let's just have fun while the party's, you know, going, right? So I think the view in future studies would be to critically assess our emotional landscape and our cognitive landscape with reflect to our image with the future. One of the founders of future studies, he's a man named Fred Pollack. He wrote that civilizations that have a positive image of the future or an animating image of the future actually create motivation. They create power within that society. So one of his diagnoses is that we are affected by like a malaise of negative imagery around the future. And we're struggling to find positive images of the future. And the person who translated his work into English was a woman named Elise Boulding. She was an incredible scholar in her own right, a feminist, futurist, and she wrote several books on the underside of history. So she documented the emerging images of the future that give us hope, that give us pathways. And so she saw what Pollack was saying and said, okay, well, if that's part of the malaise, then how do we find these new pathways? What are the new images? And I think at least over the last half century, the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s were really a rich time of the emergence of new images for the future. I think the fact that we're living in a time of the decline of U.S. hegemony and the grip that the fossil fuel industries and capitalism has on that empire means that it's kind of like the extra weight that we have to carry as we try to find new pathways. You know, we're being pulled back. As we're trying to go forward, we're being pulled back. But I would say personally that I'm optimistic long term. I think in the short term, we are going to have to go through quite a lot of pain. That pain is fundamental transition in lifestyles, transition in energy, and political transitions. Long term, what I would say is that we're moving into a post-Holocene world, that we've been in this Holocene for the last 12,000 years or so, and that human beings, we're cultural beings, so we tend to pattern our way into particular forms of human life that we assume are going to last. They're just going to keep on going. And the Holocene was a period, you know, that we're still right at the tail end of really good weather, really good conditions for human civilization. We're moving out of that. We're moving into a new period of human existence that we're not going to have that climate certainty. We're going to have to do unprecedented things. We're going to have to learn how to govern our planetary commons, our atmospheric commons. That is a huge step change for a primate that just came out of the savannas of Africa a few hundred thousand years ago. And what that means is it's a huge cultural change. It's not going to happen overnight. So that's just one of the challenges in a post-Holocene world. How do we collectively govern, manage our atmospheric commons?
One of the biggest problems that we face, Jose, is the widening gap between rich and poor, which is at the root of many of our social problems. Can you, or any of the people that you're engaged with at the moment, can you see any way at all of closing that gap and making life fairer for the growing number of humans on the planet whose life is worse every year by taking something from the small number who just get richer every year? Surely, if it carries on this way, we're heading for another revolution.
Yeah, I mean, every country produces its own pathologies. You know, if you look at the United States, you know, the high rate of incarceration, the opioid epidemic, cultures produce their own unique pathologies. As societies, as cultures, we have to have a strong emphasis on equity. We have to build a value of equity. We have to build a value of care that has to be built into the fabric of governance. It cannot be just, some kind of political football that we kick around. So to me, that's going to take a very deliberate effort where a worldview that we understand that we live with, everyone in society we live with, our children will live with, their children's children will live with in perpetuity into the future. Why would we create a world that's unequal, where we're going to create social problems that our children and their children's children are going to have to live in? So I think that has to be applied into how we create the political economies, our social economic structures. And obviously capitalism has an incredibly powerful force, and it influences governments, and it undermines legislative processes in many different countries. So these are things that we have to be deliberate about.
Jose, are you aware of, or is there any group of people that gives you optimism, like you see them as going in the right direction?
Oh, I see many groups, and many more than I am personally aware of, doing many creative things around the world. You know, it just depends on where you're talking, what sector, what field. If you want to look, for example, in the U.S., you know, there's many people that understand that governance is broken, that something new needs to be fundamentally reborn. There's many efforts there. We know that the food system is incredibly unsustainable, and there's people working on regenerative farming all over the world, all over. You know, the permaculture international movement is vibrant, and there's people that are creating incredible systems and experiments in many different parts of the world. There's people that are working on climate and health equity. You know, that's a huge process, because people know that we're going into the post-Holocene. We're going to have to find a way to support people's health in this changing climate. So I see a lot, and I it's just a non-exhaustive list of creativity. You know, as you would know, Paul Hawken wrote the book Blessed Unrest. And you know, he said that for any problem that humanity is facing, there's an autoimmune response, that people from all over the planet will respond to that challenge or that problem. And I see that with everything. I see that from, if you just even look at how renewables have just completely transformed over the past 30 years. It is unrecognizable, right? Like 30 years ago, we were just dreaming we would be in this situation where renewable, you know, in the U.S., I think I saw that little stat that renewables just surpassed coal. Incredible, right? So I'm with Paul Hawken on this. You know, I see the blessed unrest, and I see people from all over. Does that mean that the short term is going to be easy? I don't think it is. I think it's growing pains. I think it's the butterfly has to fight its way out of the chrysalis, and that is not an easy thing to do. But I am optimistic. I would say cautiously optimistic in the long term, because human beings are cultural beings. So if we learned a kind of an industrial form that was unsustainable over several hundred years, we can unlearn that. We can learn something new.
Feel the pulse. Feel the beat. A new world beats at our feet. A vision bright under the stars. Reweaving the stories of who we are.
Well, the Houston thrust is going.
Feel the
engines.
Pulse.
You're looking good.
Feel the beat.
Roger, you're loud and clear, Houston.
What if we take a new perspective? The web of life.
This is Houston. You are confirmed to go for orbit.
The web of life being that we are a species among many species, understanding the interconnections between these different ecosystems, different beings, a deep respect for the beings that live around us, whether they're bugs or birds or mountains or forests. And what if we took that new perspective into a place, a domain? You know, I see the blessed unrest, and I see people from all over be this larger idea that we share this planet, that we're brothers and sisters, and that we're in this together.
Our feet.
And Janet will fly.
together.
A vision bright under the stars.
We're in this together.
Reweaving the stories of who we are.
We're in this together. So if we learned a kind of an industrial form that was unsustainable over several hundred years, we can unlearn that. We can learn something new.
So Jose, we have a new player in the room. And last week we heard Colin, he referred to a federal politician who had given a speech. And the speech was basically about human extinction because of artificial intelligence. It's coming. And I see what he's talking about, because what AI does is it amplifies who we are as humans. So if we are dominating, if we have bad intentions, then AI can be used to amplify that. If we're good, it can also amplify good, of course. But there is a worry here, because we have, as you talked about, the long perspective, we have centuries and millennia of tradition, in a way, for men being very dominating and nature and women being oppressed. And if we then put that into our AI systems, that attitude, we're in trouble.
I don't disagree with you. I think there's a couple layers for me. I think humanity's relationship with technology is vexed because we're technological beings, and technology was the way in which that was our success formula. You know, we began using fire, we began cooking. It transformed our gut. It transformed the size of our brain. We began developing tools. We're a continuum with technology from the very beginning. So it's not us and technology, because we are expressing technology as an expression of our being. But we're very unconscious about it. I think that was partly what I get from Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey. It's this really unconscious relationship that we have. That we're like the, you know, I wish I could find a metaphor for that, but, you know, we're the car driving really fast and there's a cliff, but we're not slowing down, you know, we're, so I think that partly it's a species level challenge, I would say, that we have to mature as a species and we have to begin to own the technological impacts and reverberations that we have. And we just keep on doing it. You know, we did it with fossil fuels. We did it with nuclear technology. Now we're doing it with AI. And we're going to do it with genetic engineering. Like, it just, like, sometimes I think, is it human beings? We love it so much. It's a reason why we can have this conversation as well. You know, it's got a real duality to it. But then at the other level, I would say, is the political economy. If you got a capitalist political economy, then expect what you got when we were, you know, when we saw the big social networking platforms commodify relationships, commodify our data. How is this going to be any different? And then, like you said, you know, these things are powerful and they can amplify the power that we have. I couldn't agree more, you know, and in that regard, like, if you look at traditional societies, they regulated human behavior. So there's this vein in Western philosophical thinking around liberalism that we should be able to do what we want to do as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. But that whole "it doesn't hurt anyone else" is usually the thing that's left until something seriously gets hurt. So I think we have to, again, like, yeah, we have to rethink. We have to rethink how our societies function. I think AI should force that kind of rethinking. And we need to really think, you know, what's an appropriate engagement with that? Not even just the use of our data itself and the way that it's building off our own use of data is incredibly problematic. There's so many things in AI. That's 10 podcasts just there, isn't it?
So. But so do you get where I'm trying to get at, in a way? Because what I'm saying is, if we are to, you know, stand a chance to survive, we need to have more focus on the masculine, the dominating attitude of humans.
Yeah. I agree with that. I agree with that. I think that there's particular unconscious ways of seeing the world, of behaving, patriarchal or domination of nature, not understanding ourselves as part of the web of life that we sit atop. I think there's some pretty fundamental assumptions that sit within the current way of living. And I think that, yeah, I wouldn't disagree. If you add more power to that, one of Herman Daly's points, he talked about donut economics before it was donut economics, right? The steady state society. And he said, the problem isn't that we don't have enough energy, it's that we have too much energy. You know, we have so much energy that we can impact the world around us in such a disproportionate way. So I would take Daly's, comment and kind of put it on top of what you're saying. That if you have a particular worldview and the power to change, yeah, of course. Worldview plus power equals something, right? There's an equation there.
You're on listening to On the Sustainable Hour to Jose Ramos, and Mick's eager to ask another question.
Yes, I am, because I would like to hear your version of what do we do about it then?
Well, what I focus on in my work is, and a lot of my colleagues and the people that I've learned from, is around what might be, in academic terms, you'd call it epistemological intervention. In lay terms, we would say, what's a new way of seeing the world and understanding the world? And then bringing forth action from that new place. So I'll give you an example. Instead of that, you talked about the domination mindset, right? That might, associated with, the Judeo-Christian tradition, the man at the top and man above nature, et cetera, right? Well, what if we take a new perspective, which is very common to pre-industrial societies and indigenous societies, the web of life. The web of life being that we are a species among many species, understanding the interconnections between these different ecosystems, different beings, a deep respect for the beings that live around us, whether they're bugs or birds or mountains or forests. And what if we took that new perspective into a place, a domain? What if I'm working in fashion? What if I'm working in energy? And if I take a new perspective, and then I say, well, from this perspective, what new opportunities does this bring forth? What new perspectives on the future does this bring forth? So that's an epistemological intervention. It's taking a new perspective, taking a new discourse, taking a new paradigm, taking a new, and it could be within, these are embedded and embodied across the world, that there's people from everywhere that have this diversity. But that diversity tends to get pushed out by the logic of the dominant system. But it's there. Here in Australia, it's here with what I would say the bush mechanic, the bush mechanic, which might come from the convict background, or there's different threads here that I think are very profound. They're very rich. There is the indigenous people. Even within here, we've got a diversity of communities and people that see the world differently. And it's about leaning into those types of thinking, exploring it and seeing what avenues that they give us. A lot of these will just be experiments in thinking. They'll help us to see the world differently or understand the world differently, but some of them might actually help produce solutions. And it's an exploratory process. It isn't there's no logical flow from one thing to another that you're going to get this, automatic kind of solution. So that's how we work, and my colleagues work, is we're looking for new perspectives. I use the logic of the commons, because the commons makes a lot of sense. I draw on Eleanor Ostrom and Christian Iaioni on the urban commons, and many other people who've talked about the commons. You know, there's a variety, there's a whole community around commoning. To me, that's one of the best frameworks for understanding our contemporary challenges. So that's a different perspective or paradigm from which to come at the challenges that we're facing. But then there's many other perspectives as well that I think are incredibly important. And it's about exploring those and honoring the diverse knowledge that exists in society. We have incredible resources in that diversity of thinking. And oftentimes that thinking is not being given the light of day because of that dominance, you know, because of the logic of that dominance of the main system.
That's how much talk about the future we could fit into one sustainable hour today. Thank you very much to José Ramón. So, José, if people have become interested in this field, do you have some recommendations to where should we go and find more of what you're talking about?
The best resource, and I'm biased here because I'm a co-editor for the journal, but it's an open access journal. It's been going since 1992. So it's got several decades behind it. It literally has over 1,000 articles that are open access. It's called the Journal of Future Studies. And you can find everything from short essays to 3,000 word things on every topic. Every topic, including personal futures, including, you know, everything under the sun. And it's free. So that's a great resource. I would point people towards the Journal of Future Studies. If you're interested in the work that I do, it's futureslab.org.
Now, this is going to be interesting. We always have a B section in the Sustainable Hour. We call it the B section because we are asking you, José, to come up with what should we be? When you think about it, what should we be?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that comes to me, and this is very personal, is that this experience we're having is incredibly impersonal. You know, why am I conscious in this body at this time? Why wasn't I born you from your mother? Why wasn't I born from somebody else? We could have been anyone. And the sages of the past, from the Buddha or Jesus or Muhammad or many others, told us we're brothers and sisters. And that's also what evolutionary science tells us, that we're brothers and sisters. And then in contemporary philosophy, people like John Rawls and his Veil of Ignorance say, if you're going to create a society in which you could be any one of those people and still be happy, still be cared for. Right? So to me, the being would be, you know, don't be yourself. But maybe be this larger idea that we share this planet, that we're brothers and sisters, and that we're in this together.
If we are not able to reverse the present trend that is leading to catastrophe in the world, we will be doomed.
This is big stuff we're talking about.
We will be doomed.
We have to move rapidly.
First we saw it as a climate crisis, then we found it to be so much more. As threads began to unravel and the meta crisis converged, inequality control, oligarchs and emperors. The world we knew started crumbling, but that's when we found direction. We discovered that old song of the natural evolution. There's a signal in the chaos. There's a stirring in the wave. This is our time. This is our reality. This is our symphony of the shift.
This is big stuff we're talking about. Requires the citizens to organize themselves first.
They were midwives of what came next. as humans gave birth to a values-based path, interconnected indigenous directions, seabeds emerging, regeneration. There was an invitation, there was collective imagination. The mechanics were the easy part, the mindset was the harder climb. Breaking down hierarchies, stopping extraction and the greed. There's a signal in the chaos, there's a stirring in the wave. This is our time, this is our reality, this is our symphony of the shift. The shift is not above or below, it's middle up. It's local, it's conscious, it's creative, it's alive.
It will be a global, values-based civilization where nation states have disappeared completely. We view each other as a global family, caring for the host that is carrying us around this universe, because the planet itself is evolving and we are agents of that evolutionary process.
Not in palaces, not with power, but in hands that plant, in hearts that listen, co-create with compassion. Every rupture opens doors to complexity, a call to coherence.
It will be a global, values-based civilization.
Evolutionary impulse. We found our voice.
I have a plan.
Found our voice.
These are our choices. These are our values. This is our world.
Is this all going to happen in time?
When we listened, we could hear the world ask us to grow up and come home.
I have a computer engineering background and I work in the manufacturing space, and I know we can make it happen. Starting at self-sufficiency, then you got communal coordination, local systems, national infrastructure, global consciousness. At a small scale, I plan to start bartering in my local community and then start a UPIC community garden. But in order to make this a reality for a lot of people, here's my plan. Sharing the start of my journey and how I'm using tech to work in hand with nature, teaching and spreading awareness, gaining a following, building a network, and raising capital, then building systems in alignment, setting new standards, and driving change. Humanity's collective consciousness is calling for better, but we must build it from the ground up, just as today's world was built in the visions of those that decided to.